Welcome to the Risk Podcast number 433. I'm here at the At Midnight Studios. Katie, Kyle, to my left. Hey guys, how's it going?
Hi.
No Jonah Ray for this hostful intro. No Matt Myra for this hostful intro. I don't want you guys to feel like you're...
secondary?
Okay, all right. You know, I wasn't... I didn't mean... Oh, poor Kyle said tertiary. Tertiary. I love you guys. It's so fun to do these intros alone. But we're at the At Midnight Studios. At Midnight is still on for a couple more weeks on Comedy Central, and so watch it. It's on Monday through Thursday after Colbert. It's actually doing pretty well. So watch it. Jump in the hashtag wars. We still have a lot of great comedians coming up. We'll be on till the... I don't know. What's the date today? The 5th. We're on this week and next week in November. And then hopefully we'll be back next year. So we'll see. We will see what is in the cards for At Midnight. I'd like to thank for sponsoring this episode of the Nerds Podcast, Squarespace.com. It's the all-in-one platform that makes it easy to create your own professional website, portfolio, or online store. For a free trial and 10% off, you're going to want to go to Squarespace.com, use the offer code NERDIST11. It changes all the time, Katie.
It's for the month.
It is. Every month they change, so that's why. So if they're a sponsor for a really long time, it could be like, the offer code is NERDIST472. Because that's how I'll talk by that point. If there still is an internet by that point, who knows? We'll probably all be connected through some sort of a thought net that we don't even have to have machines anymore. We can just access things like... tertiary. Oh, poor Kyle. Squarespace is incredibly easy to use. They have an incredible support team that is 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. So if you have any questions, if you have any problems, they're going to help you get through it. It starts just $8 a month and includes a free domain name if you sign up for a year. No matter what level of programmer you might be, if you're a beginner or if you know a little more complex, if you know CSS, if you know whatever you are, you can build on Squarespace.com. So again, go to Squarespace.com, use the offer code NERDIST11, get 10% off, and show your support for the Nerdist podcast. Thanks for their support. This is continuing Marvel Week, which has been very exciting. Clark Gregg was Monday, and today is Tom Hiddleston. Friday is Kevin Feige. And Hiddleston is every bit as damn charming and delightful as you would hope and expect that he is. He really is. Katie's...
He's the most handsome man.
Katie, there's a little bit of drool pooling at the corners of your mouth.
Like, ridiculous.
Yeah, he is. He's handsome. It's not even just handsome. It's just like he's charismatic.
Yeah,
British way. The conversation was so much fun. And then afterwards, he was like, "Oh, we talked about Thor some. Should we talk about it more?" I go, "No, you're talking about Thor a ton because it's coming out Friday, November 8th. And so he's just been talking about Thor for the past month because it premiered internationally first. And so it was fun to get a peek behind the Hiddleston curtain. And I do quite enjoy that the conversation spun into who he would want to play in Harry Potter. I should have said Voldemort. He would have been a great Voldemort.
Oh yeah, he would be great.
He would have been like a young Tom Riddle. Stun. Riddle stun. You guys, the clues were there the whole time. Anyway, Hiddleston was someone that people have asked us a long time for. When are you going to get him on? The answer is now, during Marvel Week. The delightful. He is at TW Hiddleston on Twitter. So follow him and get some digital tweet charm. Here's the Nerds Podcast, episode number 433 with Tom Hiddleston.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Yeah. It was New York Comic Con, and we'll just start talking
okay,
now.
Sure.
So, yeah, New York Comic Con in 2012.
New York Comic Con, October 2011.
Yeah.
When I was there with Avengers with Mark Ruffalo and Chris Evans and Kobe Smulders and Clark Gregg.
Yes, and Clark just gave me shit because I called him out on stage for singing his Avengers theme that he improvised backstage.
Yeah. How did it go? It was some extraordinary. He'd made it up. It was like.
I don't remember. It was something like.
was like a rap. It was like...
Yeah, and we... I just remember the line, we got a Hulky or something. I don't remember what it was, but he was...
You gotta call the Avengers.
He was... It was... Yeah. Yeah, he was basically just screwing around backstage, and I thought it was hilarious, and then when I said, oh, you should do this, he was like, no, please. Please, no. And then he did it, and it was great. People were thrilled.
It was great. People loved it. People loved Clark Gregg. I love Clark Gregg.
People love Tom Hiddleston. Tom Hiddleston. I mean, this... You know, to basically... get to be, I mean, essentially, Loki is, he's might as well be an Avenger at this point as far as people are concerned.
They
adore him.
It's very gratifying and thrilling that he is a loved character.
Yes.
I don't know that that Joss is going to invite me to be part of the that particular team anytime soon. But it has been an amazing run, an amazing ride. That Comic-Con, I think, was the first time I became aware that it was becoming a different thing.
A lot of times in superhero movies, the villain can be kind of disposable. It's like, oh, he's just the threat for this particular episode.
The plot.
He's done, and then you don't ever see him again. And then, but I honestly think people would riot if Loki went away. I think people would freaking riot. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, let's see what happens, because he ain't in the Avengers 2. So, you know.
God damn it. Katie, get Joss on the phone. Okay, we'll get his number.
Yeah, but it's been a roller coaster. For me, for everybody else, the whole thing has been such an extraordinary year.
One of my favorite moments, because we had Kevin Feige on, and that podcast is going up after yours, and we talked about this on his, but one of my favorite moments at any Comic-Con was not just you coming out as Loki, but there was a moment where you came out, and I told you the night before, I was like, people are going to lose their fucking minds. And you're like, you think it's going to be okay? I said, it's going to be. And you go, I'm sure it'll be fine. I go, no, it's going to be amazing. And then you came out, and the response was deafening. And I just, you couldn't contain the smile on your face. And I'm like, that's not Loki. That's Tom smiling. That's Tom smiling.
It's so insane and ridiculous. I could never have expected that. No, but you would never expect it. Like, it was crazy. I mean, I nearly burst out laughing. Partly because, here's the thing, is that I don't know if he ever told you this, is while I was off stage, the first time I tried to say my first off stage lines, my microphone wasn't working. I was like, oh God, it's over. This is not going to work. All I have is my voice.
Right.
There are no special effects. There is me and my voice reaching the back wall in a hall full of 7,000 people, and the microphone's not working. Holy shit. Theater-trained actor, I still don't have a voice that can reach all the way back that far.
That's a big room.
So I was sweating. I was sweating and panicking. And finally, on the third go, I said, "Humanity," and I heard it reverberate around Hall H. I was like, "Whoo!"
It worked out because it takes hours to go through to add the hair and the makeup and the
yeah,
and
it takes 2 hours. Yeah,
yeah, And I was very pleased to be a part of it. I think you called me a mewling quim, which
I
was
did.
Amazing.
Yeah, just you are distinguished by that privilege. You share that only with Scarlett Johansson. There are two people in the world that call them mewling quim.
We have so much in common.
You do. You should be wearing a catsuit. Why are you not wearing a catsuit?
Normally, if it's weird during the day,
yeah,
because it's sort of like the topography of everything in my body,
of
really.
Course.
Yeah, but at night, it sort of blends in, so I try not to do it too much during
just
the day.
Bumps in the wrong places.
It just looks like, it's like, I got this bag of gravel. What should I do with this? Like, that's what I look. Maybe to the premiere tonight, the Thor premiere tonight.
Come.
I'll wear the catsuit.
Yeah.
I'm always half tempted to do something like that at a premiere, but then I always feel like, you're just going to look like a sad attention whore comic if you do that. But I always want to do
that. I think
it'd
be hilarious if you did that. I love it when people turn up in costume.
I wanted to wear a Loki helmet.
You should do that. Honestly, people, because I think your interviews with us will be better. Because everyone's like, oh, this is great. Here we go.
Well, it went to Disneyland, and they have this like this Thor experience, and then you go into this one room, and they have the Loki helmet and a bunch of pieces from the...
They do.
Yeah, and it was a little special tour that I got. I was like, no one else is in here. I could just take that, and no one would know.
Is it the actual helmet that I wore?
I don't know if it's the actual helmet.
I bet
but
it is, actually.
It might be.
I bet. Is it?
Did they give you one?
Is it? No, they didn't.
What?
Because it's at Disneyland.
It does.
Is it the Thor one or the Avengers one?
It's the Thor one.
Because the Thor one is slightly more like a crown, and the Avengers one is more like a kind of weapon.
It's the one that's got the horn. They go up and back.
Yeah, up and back, as opposed to out front and
that's
back.
Right. Yeah, that's right. How long? When did you guys finish this? How long have
we finished? We shot Thor: The Dark World from mid-August 2012 to mid-January 2013.
Okay,
that was the principal photography.
Oh wow!
And I and Chris and I did the last day, so that was I guess January the 15th.
Holy shit! And now, of course, is anyone are people like, where's the Loki movie? I mean, it's totally within the Marvel universe to have a Loki movie somewhere. Probably should ask Kevin Feige that. He probably knows.
Yeah, you should really ask him. Well. The equivocation begins. I've heard that there's a lot of people asking that question, and it's the most enormous compliment. Like, there are people online saying you've got to have one, people saying you should, you know, this should be a Loki movie. I mean, I'd love to do it. I have so many harebrained ideas I'd love to try out. But in the end, it won't be up to me, I think. And also, I think it would be strange to do, like, I think Chris Hemsworth would have to be in it in some capacity. Or maybe, I don't know. Anyway, I don't know what form it would take, because in a way, there is no Thor without Loki. There is no Loki without Thor. They define each other. They oppose each other, they need each other, they love each other, they hate each other, they are two halves of the same whole, I think. So I wonder how it would work. However, as I have stated before, I'd love to see Loki just on kind of like expeditions in mischief on Earth across the 20th century. I think it would be amazing. I think you could see him, like, you know, hanging with the Rolling Stones in the late 60s.
You know how you make that work? I'll tell you how you make that work right now. The Doctor picks up Loki.
Yes.
And they travel in the TARDIS together. And
that's how you make that work.
That's how you make that work.
That would be amazing.
Dropping Loki into Doctor Who. Well, first of all, he's a part of Norse mythology. Yeah. So it is every bit reasonable to say that the Doctor could find Loki somewhere.
Doctor could find Loki. Loki travels in the TARDIS. They go back to 1968. He's introduced to Keith Richards. He starts playing as a fifth member of the Rolling Stones.
That's right.
Please allow me to introduce myself. I'm a man of wealth and taste. Pleased to meet you. Hope to guess my name. Say my name!
Loki!
Say my name!
Loki!
But what's puzzling
you see how this works?
Nature of my game.
Wait a minute. This is starting to make a lot of sense, because I think the Rainbow Bridge is more alien technology than it is supernatural technology.
Yes.
The fucking North gods, the Norse gods, are an alien race.
They are.
This is, I mean, just fucking Moffat, Feige, fix it. Just here, do it.
It would be amazing.
Oh my God.
Be amazing?
Yeah. Were you a Doctor Who fan at all?
I certainly was, yeah.
Nice.
And now it's Peter Capaldi, so it would be an older Doctor Who.
It is, but an older, super sharp, hilarious.
Yeah.
I'm excited.
Me too. I mean, he's brilliant. He's a brilliant, brilliant actor. That could be interesting. He also has a capacity for going to the dark side in a great way.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Did you ever see The Thick of It?
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
So,
yeah, incredible. He's amazing and hilarious. Yeah. And I think a really interesting way to... They had to go in a completely different direction with that.
Yeah.
They had to go in a totally... You know, it couldn't just be like it's a young white chap who's...
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
like
yeah,
they had
one.
To go...
Yeah.
I think they had to go another ethnicity, or they had to go older, or they had to go female. Like, they had to do something with the Doctor. Yeah.
He will be amazing, actually. I'm looking forward to seeing what he does.
This, I think a lot of what Americans view, or at least what I view of sort of British actor culture, is that there is basically a basket of you, and you all do everything over there. It's like the community is so much smaller, and everyone appears. How many period dramas have you done?
Let me count. Cranford, The Gathering Storm, Conspiracy, Miss Austin Regrets, Nicholas Nickleby.
Wow.
At least that's five I can think of off the top of my head. But then do you count like War Horse? That's a period drama.
Sure.
Midnight in Paris? That's a period
Absolutely.
Drama.
Absolutely. Yeah.
The Deep Blue Sea.
I think because what I see of...
I basically do period drama. That's what I do. I got told once on my first job, actually. My very first job when I was 19 years old was a TV adaptation of Nicholas Nickleby. With James Darcy and Dominic West, and Charles Dance and Sophia Miles as the leads. And I got told by the makeup artist on my very first day of professional work as an actor, "You know, Tom, you have a very period face." I was like, "What does that mean? What does that mean? It's 1999. What does that mean?"
That means it's adaptable to any... Because there are some people, like if you watch Mad Men or if you watch old periods, you go, "Oh, yeah, yeah, they've got the face for that time period." Because every time period... You just can tell, like, oh, it's maybe it's the haircuts or maybe it's the environment, but they are just of that era. And there are some people that are, you just, oh, slick their hair back or just give them and some mutton chops.
Like, yeah. All British people, essentially. It feels like.
That's half my lineage. You know, my father's side of the family is some type of Anglo mutt. I'm not sure. Yeah. There's a little bit of Scottish and some Northern English. So, you know.
So it's period and sci-fi. And what else do we do that I can think of? A bit of song and dance.
But you're
Scottish. Is Scottish in this?
Yeah, there's Scottish. There's Scottish in my dad's family. I think it's
how far back?
McCrory. I think it back to the early 20th century.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
I was thinking like maybe your grandfather was Scottish or something.
No. My grandfather was a hillbilly. They all, you know, it's like the Northern English and Scots, and they came over and they basically settled in regions in America that were very environmentally Scottish, like the Appalachians or the, you know. And so, yeah, my great-grandfather, like, he had a washer and a dryer, and he basically made moonshine in it. Like, he didn't wash his clothes, and he lived in a cabin, and... You know, they were all rednecks.
Wow. I want to meet him. He sounds cool.
That's where you would need a TARDIS. You would need a TARDIS to go back and scare the shit out of him in your Loki helmet. But watching British television and film really is an extension of theater is kind of an interesting idea because we don't really have that here.
Yeah, I guess it's a unique thing is that's where most of us have to start is people go to drama school, and that most people do that by and large. You go to a professional, essentially a theater training. So it could be where I went, which is RADA, or where many, many, many people went, Lambda, the London Academy of Dramatic Art, Music and Dramatic Art, or Royal Scottish, or Central, or the Drama Center, where Tom Hardy went, and Paul Bettany, and Michael Fassbender, and you know, all these essentially London based drama schools. I can't remember where. Did Matt go to Matt Smith? I think he went to Guildhall or
did he
Lambda or something?
I'm not sure. I thought he was just kind of a soccer hooligan. They put on the.
No, I think he trained. Maybe there are some who don't, but then you sort of you get into the theater and you either do Shakespeare or Chekhov or sort of like edgy contemporary drama. Like I remember seeing Matt Smith in a play called That Face, where he had a very intense relationship with his mother. And suddenly became this burning white talent, everyone goes to see the plays because it's all the theaters are in Soho, which is where the film business is based and the television industry, and so it all becomes in a way the theater as an actor, theater feeds television and film, and TV and film producers and casting directors come to the theatre to look for new actors. But also there is so much theatre in London. I mean, I do think London has the best theatre in the world. I would say that, of course.
Sure, of course.
I'm biased, but it is an amazing progressive industry which is full of people. And in a way you get to test the tools of your trade and you get to kind of try out the things in your toolbox and broaden your range and play, you know, play outside your comfort zone. And then I think, in a way, you're lucky if you get a TV and film break, but you've always got some sort of foot in an anchor in the theater.
It is pretty amazing how America became so obsessed with Downton Abbey, which I know is an amazing show, even though I haven't seen that much of it. But that idea of like the upstairs, downstairs relationships is not like that's a very... That's recurred a lot. Like, there was actually a show called Upstairs, Downstairs.
There was a show called Upstairs, Downstairs.
Which was the sort of the poshies upstairs and then downstairs the servants and how they interact with one another. It's a very British ideal because that was essentially your social structure.
It used to be. That's what's interesting is that genuinely I find it... I mean, I know it's a very popular show and it's very well made and lots of my friends are in it. But it's such an interesting thing that it's so not what Britain is now.
Right. Like,
Britain is actually a very progressive place, and the energy is really I feel like it's the I hope, but the country is trying to just do away with the class system because we know how poisonous and toxic it is, and was for so long. And yet we're still fascinated by how it used to be. You know, we look back, all of our stories constantly, we're looking back to a time when to make sense of who we are now.
Sure.
Which is fascinating in a way, is a sort of cultural method of self-examination.
Well, our country, I mean, you know, we're obviously young.
Yes.
compared to yeah. you guys. We broke away from you guys, it turns out, a long time ago.
Yeah.
But you know, I don't know if we really, I mean, so much of our culture around the Victorian era was essentially us finding the land of this country and establishing it, not part of this historical, lineage that had to, carry on. And like, we were not established. So our history in that period of time was just establishing a culture.
Yeah.
Period.
Which is a great culture, by the way. I love America. I love coming here. I love its youth. I love its energy. I love, I've loved that it isn't old, particularly that things are, in a way, you process your inheritance more. So people are like actively processing their inheritance. Like, I have no idea what, like, beyond my grandfather, my great grandfather, I really have no idea what my family history is. Whereas I feel like in America, everyone knows, like, oh no, I've got Irish in my blood from 150 years ago. I'm like, really, you know that? and I find that really interesting. Is people are like actively processing their cultural inheritance and changing it and using it and spinning it. And that's why it's such an energetic country, genuinely.
Yeah, because we're, you know, everyone here is from somewhere.
Yeah.
But, you know, people in England could have been there for multiple
millennia.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I know I'm half Scottish and half English. And so my father's side is all Scots. And he has a Scottish accent. My grandfather, his dad, had a really strong Glaswegian accent. Used to call him up on Sundays with my very English London accent, say, "How are you, Grandpa?" And he'd say, "Oh, I'm an absolute champion. It's terrible. I was watching a football Celtic, beat the Rangers at Celtic Park the other day," and he'd be like, "I'm not quite sure, Grandpa. Can you repeat that?" But my dad, you know, still speaks with a Scottish accent. He'd be like, "Oh, I saw The Dark World. I loved it. Fantastic. You know, great, great, lots of twists and turns. It was really good." So that's my dad. And mom is from an English family, but I think there's a bit of German in there. And then who the hell knows if the Scots somehow came over from Scandinavia or, I mean, I don't know who the Hiddlestons were. My dad said we can trace our he can't whether I believe him or not is another matter, but he can trace the Hiddleston blood back to the Douglas clan.
Oh.
Like, because all the Scots are divided into clans, you know, there's the MacDonalds and the you know, your various Tartans and all that, the Hiddleston clan is part. The Hiddlestons are part of the Douglas clan, and there was a guy called the Black Douglas who went out in the Crusades and fought. He was a madman, and he fought the.
There's always the ones who get the special names are always the one that's. They're always the ones that have slaughtered thousands of people, and they get color names like Red this,
yes.
or Black that, or the Gray. Like everyone's.
I know.
If you fucked a lot of people up, you get a color attached to your name. That's what I learned. That's what I've learned.
I should do some more homework, shouldn't I? Black Douglas. Anyway, he sounds like a badass, doesn't he?
Do you want to do comedy? Do you like comedy?
Very much, yeah. That's genuinely where I started as a performer, as a kid. Like, I started just making people laugh. I'm not being very funny right now. I'm kind of aware of that. But
so your admission of that was funny. So
yeah, I would love to. I'd love to do it. I mean, I feel like I'm as low key. I'm starting to be allowed to be funny,
right?
And there have been things I've done sort of incidentally where I've got to be just, you know, take the piss out of myself a bit and have fun and be stupid and doing impressions and I used to be when I was a kid. I used to literally entertain my cousins. We'd all get together over the summer and they would say like a command, "Be funny, Tom." So I remember, you know, space hopping myself into a wall and smashing my face on it and thinking that really hurt, but they were all laughing and feeling really happy about it.
And that never really stops, actually. That's really what comedy is for the rest of your life, is smashing your face into a wall and hoping people find it funny.
That's it. Yeah.
And if not, you have a smashed up face.
That's it. Yeah. I remember Rowan Atkinson doing a sketch where he was basically like walking down the street, and there's a guy filming him walking down the street, and he isn't aware that he's being filmed. And then after a certain point, he's like, oh, I'm being filmed. And he starts kind of like being a bit flirtatious with the camera and be like, oh, I'm being filmed. I'm obviously very popular and interesting. And he develops this extreme and absurd relationship with the camera on the other side of the street and walks straight into a lamppost. And it's just absurd and impossible not to laugh.
Was that so when you, so British comedy, you were growing up, Rowan Atkinson, Blackadder?
Blackadder particularly, mm-hmm. I loved. I mean, Fawlty Towers is a piece of pure genius. John Cleese's blind rage at human nature. He just hates people. It's Basil Fawlty. And the fact that he wants to be a better person, but his basic misanthropy just pulls out the rug from under his feet at any moment. That was what I grew up watching. And then if I still put on episodes of the first season of The Office with Ricky Gervais, it makes me like howl and shake with laughter, just the awkwardness of it. And I think it's genius. And also, American comedy is amazing. I was a Curb Your Enthusiasm nut for ages, just watching.
Curb to me is a very, the soul of it's pretty British, I think.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, misunderstandings and awkwardness.
Yeah. And snobbery.
And snobbery.
And telling the truth when you really shouldn't tell the truth. Like, when you're supposed to keep a lid on it.
Yeah.
It's just, I mean, I remember there, and people being so game, as well, people like Rosie O'Donnell and Ted Danson coming in and being incredibly game with Larry David. I would love to do like a really kind of, I'd love to do a romantic comedy. I think they're really hard. I'd love to try that. And I'd love to do, I think Paul Feig's films are genius. I mean, what he's doing of late, I love watching The Heat I saw recently.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Melissa McCarthy is an amazing talent.
Yep. And he did Bridesmaids.
He did Bridesmaids,
he worked on Freaks and Geeks.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
He's great.
Paul's fantastic. Yeah. And the best dresser in Hollywood. If you ever see guy,
yeah,
he's always in an immaculate suit. He looks amazing.
I know him a bit. I met him and his wife a couple of times. He's a great guy. Sweet man.
So what is it that, like, ultimately what sort of motivates you? Is it the craft of acting, or is it specific roles, or is it, I mean, is there anything else that you ever want to do, or is...
It's sort of like it's always wanting to try something new. Like, it's all, and sort of wanting to be able to do as much as I can and keep it interesting for both myself and hopefully for the audience, is I have a big interest in straight, serious drama. Always have done. I love doing Shakespeare. I'm going back to do Coriolanus on stage in December. That's where I started doing Othello, Cymbeline, Henry V. I recently played on television. It aired on the BBC and on PBS. And that's kind of like, that's just a sort of passion, a unique and specific passion I have. And I've loved basically taking my Shakespeare experience and sort of using it in things like Loki. You know, Loki's got quite a Shakespearean stature.
Well, as we know, all villains have a British accent.
Right.
Apparently.
Yeah. I don't know why that is.
I don't know why that is.
I think it started with James Mason.
It might have started with James Mason.
I'm looking forward to death, your next role. I've always honestly wanted to do everything. I'm giddy with the idea that I've already done what I've been allowed to do, to be a supervillain, to play F. Scott Fitzgerald, to work with Steven Spielberg. I'm so excited. I basically don't know what's going to happen now, because I've already done things I thought would never happen.
How does Spielberg work? I mean, like, how do you work with him?
He's incredibly... The first thing that you're struck by after you get over the fact that you're working with him, which takes a while.
I would think it would take until after the production.
It does, actually.
Oh, fuck, I just worked with him. Oh, no.
Another day.
Okay.
get ready to fuck it up.
Hello, Steven. Shit, oh, that came out wrong.
That came out wrong.
I'm stupid.
No. Yeah, the first thing that is very striking is how genuinely kind he is. Kind, generous, personable, collaborative. You can't really get over the fact that he's including you in his process. And he trusts, I mean, with Warhorse, he really trusted me with my character. And was open to discussion and I guess he felt like he found the right guy, and so it was up to me now. But then to watch him, honestly, to have the privilege of watching him construct shots on a set is, I mean, there is no greater shot maker in the world alive today. It's like what would be difficult for other humans, for mere mortals, it's like water out of a tap for him. He just makes decisions and they're so clear and so clean and majestic. He just, no, what we should do is we should go. It should be, the shot should be on the horse's legs. You want to pan across and then pan back. Use this lens. We'll cut it in. Can I see it on the monitor? Great. Put this filter on. You're like, it's so exciting. And you see it come together.
Go ahead. Sorry.
No. And he's wearing his baseball cap and he looks like Steven Spielberg. Of course he does. But there he's like, you know, sometimes he's got a cigar, like it's early in the morning, baseball cap.
I always think of when you're watching someone who is a master at their craft, I always think of the scene from Amadeus where Salieri is explaining like where Mozart's writing the Requiem and he's taking the notation, and it's like he describes it as he's dictating.
Right.
That he's not even thinking of. It seems like he's dictating something from the heavens.
It's coming out.
Yeah. He's just spitting it out.
Yeah.
And to watch someone do that, do you watch and go, I want to get there someday? Or you go, I don't fucking know how that's ever going to happen. Like, that's just a...
I guess it's like watching, I don't know, it's like watching Freddie Mercury on stage or something. It's just like watching someone who's truly gifted, like watching tennis players.
But would you ever know if you got to that point? You know, like, would you ever be aware what other people always say, hey, Steven Spielberg, it's probably really amazing that you do that. And he's like, what are you talking about?
For him, it's like he's thinking at 10,000 miles a minute. You know, he's just constructing the story in his head. He has the movie in his head. That's what's such a genius thing, is he's constructed the 50,000 piece jigsaw puzzle that is the movie in his mind. And then he's just making it happen.
So how do you smash the nerves down to then go, okay, I'm about to start performing, essentially? Because I guess, yeah, well, I'm not an actor, but I'm guessing you can't be aware of yourself as an actor in a scene because you have to be in the scene. But how can you not be aware of yourself when Steven Spielberg is right there and you're like, oh, fuck, I want to do a good job?
But because he's so genuinely, he just is so supportive and loving. He's just there. Like, he's there for you. I remember there was one really intimate scene where Captain Nichols, the character I play in that film, is very brave and faces death in the face. He's incredibly courageous. That's what the character was. He's the soul of decency and courage. And there's one particular moment where you see Nichols is sort of biting his lip and burying his fear for the sake of leading his men. And we both knew it was an intimate moment for me, and Steven said just before this camera got set up, they set that Janusz Kaminski, his amazing DOP, set the lights up, and he said, Tom, I'm gonna operate on this one, if that's all right. I was like, yeah, that's absolutely fine. And then he sits on the little stool behind the camera. And he is operating, he's shooting, and it's his way of saying, it's only me and you. Just, I'm here for you.
Wow.
You know, it's so beautiful. I mean, really genuinely generous.
And do you think the first time, shit, I can do better? Or, like, do you get insecure at all? Or do you really feel that comfortable that...
I felt really comfortable because we'd had so much time together, I think. We'd had so many conversations, so much prep. And I loved my great thrill is when you can kind of tap into their director's taste. in a way. Sometimes it takes a beat, but essentially you start to understand what they love. Like, you start to get when they're really happy, and you can't fake that when they're really happy and satisfied with what you've done. And I remember doing one particular scene. I don't know if you remember, but basically it's just before Captain Nichols is killed. Spoiler alert.
Damn it.
And basically there was a scene where he said, I want to see your soul. I don't want to see fear. I don't want to see shock or terror. I just want to see your soul. I want to see this boy inside a man who is about to leave. He's about to leave, leave his life. And he knows it. And he was operating, and we did it a couple of times. And the second take, he was like, "Oh my god, that was wonderful. We got it." And because I saw in what I'd done what he was satisfied with, I said, "Can you just give me one more? Just give me." He was like, "No, I'm really happy. We got it." And I said, "Yeah, but now I know what you love. Let me just try one more thing." And so we did it a third time, and at first he was like, "I'm not sure, I think the second one was better." And then we went back, and his wife, Kate Capshaw, said, "Oh my god, the third one, oh my god." So then he said, "I'll tell you, it was a Friday, I'm editing at the weekend, I'll tell you on Monday." Monday morning, I come back on set, and he sees me, he's like, "Tom, take three, it's in the movie." And I was like, "Yes!" And it was so thrilling to feel like I was really working with him, you know.
Do you see acting as a lifelong, you know, it never ends, there's always more stuff to do? Or do you feel like at a certain point, you know?
Right now, I feel like it will never end. There's always stuff to do, because life continues to be interesting. And at every stage of my own life, I have new things to present, to portray, to excavate.
God, the life of a British actor is pretty remarkable, because you guys, you know, you start off as these like young, strapping, handsome cavalier, and then as you start to age, then you get very dignified. Then when you get older, then you're like Anthony Hopkins, where you're just
monolith,
pater familias type of guy. I mean, it is pretty amazing that if you want to work as a British actor, you can work until you drop dead.
But I'd say the same for Americans, though, right? Maybe
some of us. I don't know. I don't know if we take care of ourselves as well. Okay. I don't know if we take care of ourselves as well.
But it's like your roles evolve as you evolve.
Yeah.
Like someone once said to me, if you're lucky, your career becomes like a time machine. And you look back and you realize that the reason you played parts at a particular time is because that's what you needed to get out of your system. Like if you played lots of, I don't know, if you were playing sons or princes or soldiers or lovers or fighters or warriors, like I find I'm playing a lot of soldiers at the moment. People are sort of like, it's always about facing, basically being courageous in some way. I don't know why that is. I imagine that'll stop at some point, and maybe I'll start playing fathers and teachers or kings, or you know, hopefully one day wizards and you know.
That's really, I just imagine there's like a bunch of older British actors sitting around going, "Well, I'm finally entering my wizard phase."
Yeah,
the beard.
It's very distinguished. It's a very distinguished and exclusive club.
But you could be like Terrence Stamp and just be super badass when you're like 60.
Still be bad. Still, like, Terrence Stamp has always been a badass. He's never stopped being a badass.
Yeah.
But there are some very distinguished wizards. You know, there's Michael Gambon and Ian McKellen, and
they should start a band, the Distinguished Wizards.
The Distinguished Wizards. That sounds pretty good.
Wouldn't that be good?
Yeah.
You were not in any of the Potter films.
I wasn't. I'm in that generation. In fact, most of the actors of my generation are not.
Right.
Because we were too old.
Too old to be a student,
kids,
too young to be
teachers.
Right.
Yeah.
Maybe in the next swath of films.
You never know.
There could be something.
I think I was 20 when the first one was made, or came, or the 20 years old when the first one was released. So I'm the sort of lost Potter generation of
the lost
British
Potters.
Actors. The lost Potters.
Let's see, now you guys should all get together and be like,
there's many of us. There's
be...
Matt Smith and
that,
and Benedict Cumberbatch and Tom Hardy, and you know, we're not.
Jamie McAvoy. You guys would have been. Oh God, you just have to, just please for one Halloween, just all put yourselves in the
Harry Potter.
Yeah, would you be? Who would you be?
I don't know. Who do you think? Where would you put me? Would you make me a teacher or a pupil?
Well, let's see. If we're just discounting any age, and it's like, oh, we'll just put you in a. I don't know. I don't know who I would. Oh man,
just throw it out there. I have some ideas.
Well, maybe it's because of Loki, but I think you could make a pretty great Draco. I think you make a pretty badass Draco.
Okay,
but like a little more of a. I don't know. Draco got pretty spineless near the end, but more of like a badass Draco.
Yeah. Or maybe what's his father called?
Lucius Malfoy.
Could be Lucius Malfoy.
Yeah, he was
maybe
kind of a douchebag, though.
A young Snape.
You could be a young Snape. Yeah, like. But you're too handsome to be Snape, though. Snape's supposed to be... I mean, well, at least in the books, you know, he was kind of hideous, okay. You know? But obviously Alan Rickman, you know, like they kind of made him up to look a little more, but... I think you'd be a pretty great Snape, you know. Like if they did if they did hunky versions of the
thanks,
Hogwarts
man.
Staff, you could
thank
be
you very
a,
much.
You could be a Snape.
Thank you very much. I was thinking my hair's very ginger at the moment, so I was thinking maybe I'd be, what's his name, Rupert Grint's character.
Oh yeah. You could totally be Ron Weasley.
Ron Weasley.
You could be a Ron Weasley.
But in the end, I think I hope I reach my Dumbledore phase. I think that would be a nice place to get to. You know, not right now.
No. You know. No. You're not going to Dumbledore for several decades.
No. I have too many soldiers to play.
I have too many
soldiers and princes and warriors and poets and lovers and kings.
You know, it's like
spies and policemen.
It's like Anthony Hopkins always said, you have to soldier before you can Dumbledore.
That's right. Did he say that?
He did say that. He was never able to play Dumbledore.
Yeah, but you have to soldier before you can.
You have to soldier before you can.
Your rite of passage,
Dumbledore.
Yeah.
Is there anything? Is there anything in your? Do you have time to do anything else right now, or is it?
I'm an actor. That's what I am. Like, how do you mean in my life?
Yeah, in your life. Is there anything like? How do you? Because obviously, you know. It must be an interesting time for you because I'm sure people are throwing parts at you left and right. But at a certain point, don't you have to take a break and decompress a little bit and be Tom again for a while?
Yeah, I actually had some time actually this year, which was amazing. I went to West Africa.
Oh, wow.
To Guinea, which is on the West African coast with UNICEF. And that was amazing. That was like truly changed my perspective on the world. Because it's closer than from London to Guinea, from London to Conakry is closer than London to New York. And of course people do London to New York all the time. A lot fewer people do London to Conakry. And I saw the whole country, I saw UNICEF's work on the ground. Amazing, amazing time. Really life changing, perspective inducing, extraordinary.
And did it sort of make you feel like, oh, you know what I do is fun and playtime?
It's playtime. You know, I went into these schools with young children and I said, what do you want to be? And they all said teacher or minister or teacher or like very few people. Nobody had heard of me. And that was actually really great. I mean, of course they hadn't. But if you were in the Premiership, if your name was Lionel Messi or David Beckham or Wayne Rooney, they'd heard of you. But actors... It just didn't even register. And I loved that. I thought this is a much bigger world. The planet is much bigger than we realize, than we often think of. And so that was amazing and very affecting. And then I did a lot of traveling, actually. I did some traveling at the beginning of this year. So that was good, you know.
What is it like when you're, you know, it's nighttime. It's like your first or second night in West Africa and you're outside and you're just kind of staring up at the sky. What is it that you're thinking or feeling?
I felt very free, actually. Second night we were actually in a village in the middle of Guinea, so we were no longer by the coast, and we were staying at a house which was owned by one of the elders of the village, and it was quite special. They'd said you can stay in this room, and of course it was just a room with a bed, and you know, but that was a special thing for them. And I remember we sort of turned our torches out and I wrapped myself in my mosquito net, and it's actually hearing the noise of the West African night, all kinds of noises. I have no idea where they came from
or what was
I have
making
no idea
them.
What was making them. There was scuttling and banging and sort of hissing, and I mean it was I burst out laughing, actually. I was like, it's almost like I don't want to know what it, I don't want there to be any
it's
light.
It's better that you don't know.
Yeah, it's better that you don't know. Just because it's in the wilderness of West Africa. And then occasionally you'd hear a cow mooing and it would feel like it was just sort of standing above your face. And then I was woken up by a cockerel, you know, I genuinely walked, the cockerel just came into the room, stood next to me and crowed at about 5 a.m. I was like, I guess it's time to get up then. But I felt very free. I felt like it was an amazing world to be a part of. I was introduced to the workings of the country at quite a rigorous level. And just seeing how that part of the world is struggling to sustain itself. It felt like exercising a different part of my brain. I became really engaged in other things, you know, and that was very cool.
Well, I think it's important for, you know, not everyone has the ability to, you know, just go travel, but it's important.
I'm very blessed that they, you know, UNICEF invited me to come.
But it's so important to do that, yeah. Because I think, you know, all the insecurities we feel, all the, oh, am I not good enough? And, you know, or am I doing okay in my friend group, or is my work? And you go other places where, you know, surviving the day, getting through the day and having to sustain and having to create your own little mini civilization, and things aren't just handed to you. And you go, oh, yeah, all that shit that I'm always worried about is dumb.
I did it as soon as I rapped on the Dark World. I literally rapped on the Dark World, handed my costume in, 2 days later got on a plane to West Africa. And I remember I was in a village called Mandiana, which is just near the Malian border. And I remember walking into a meeting with all of the women folk of the health center. All these villages have health centers. And I said, because they all speak Ghanaian French, I said, il y a des problèmes dans cette village. And they were all smiling, these beautiful children, beautiful women smiling, with very little food. And they said, il n'y a pas de l'eau, which means there is no water. And it was so baldly stated, there is no water here. It hit me like a train. And whenever, you know, the sort of stuff's going on in the film business, I just sometimes think of, like, there is no water in Mandiana. Do you know what I mean? It's such a sort of shattering.
Oh, that's a wonderful that's a wonderful kind of mantra to have when you're freaking out about stupid things. Yeah. Also, I do want to point out that any female listeners probably felt their ovaries swell when you started speaking French. I was like, I'm hungry in a way I can't describe. I think Tom Hiddleston's speaking French. There may not be water, but there's Hiddleston.
I apologize unreservedly if that's the case.
I mean, that is a good thing. That is a good thing. Your French is fantastic.
I've spoken French as guests. I spoke French since I was about 10. The thing is, if you live in London, France is right there.
Yes, you have other cultures there. You know, we're so landlocked in the States. It's like,
but everyone speaks quite good Spanish, I think. There's a lot of good Spanish.
We speak okay Spanish down here, but you guys actually, you know, like it's everyone, you know,
it's
just
Europe,
sort of descends on London. But we are coming to the end of our time because the Thor premiere is tonight.
The Thor premiere is tonight.
I will be there.
I look forward to seeing you.
And you are coming to the end of a ridiculous month-long whirlwind Thor tour, so I hope that you get some rest. And are
Thank
you working
you.
Anything next that you
I literally go straight into Coriolanus tomorrow.
Oh wow.
Yeah. Back to the drawing board.
Well, you will sleep well on the plane tonight.
I will sleep well on the plane, yeah. But I'm excited. That the juice for me is making something where before there was nothing. Mm-hmm. You know, that is the thrill for me. Is there is nothing and then you make something and there is a something. You know, that could be a play or a film or and it's literally just the collective imaginations of a specific group of people saying, wouldn't it be interesting if we told this story in this way and we showed these aspects of human nature and we made it funny and gripping and dramatic and entertaining and truthful, and suddenly it becomes a thing where there was nothing before. A year ago, there was no movie called Thor: The Dark World. We made it. I mean, it sounds so trite and so obvious to say it.
No, no, but now you're creating something from nothing.
Now it's like framed and polished and it looks like it
and
just...
And it's sort of smeared into the landscape of our culture now.
And it looks so neat and and sort of framed and boxed and defined, but there wasn't anything before that. There,
well, if I anyway. Get to come to London, I want to see your play.
Please come.
I would love to.
Please come. Runs from December the 6th to February the 13th.
And then if I could ask you to do something, which hopefully is not annoying. No. We tell people at the end of the podcast, we say, enjoy your burrito, and it's a way that we're telling people to enjoy their present as it's happening.
Nice.
So it's a way, but I really feel like a good sort of low-key-esque enjoy your burrito would resonate with people okay. at the end. Okay.
Midgardians, for the sake of Odin and the Nine Realms, enjoy your burrito.
We have to play it at the end of every episode now, Kate. Tom Hiddleston, delightful to see you.
Thank you so much. Such a pleasure.
Good to see you
talk
again.
About everything. Yeah, yes. So great.
Excellent.
No, it was fantastic. You'll get to, yeah. Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
This episode of the Nerdist Podcast is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website, portfolio, or online store. For a free trial and 10% off, go to squarespace.com. Use the offer code Nerdist11.